Hello and welcome to another episode of Challenger Cities with me, Ian Montgomery. This episode is really, really good. It's with a lady called Nama Blonder, and she's an architect and urban planner from Toronto. I know, Toronto people all the time. But she's great because I don't know what it is with Toronto. It's a city that's kind of mid, but it has so many amazing people with great ideas, doing amazing work to try and make cities like Toronto and many others better places to live, play and work. Now, the reason I wanted to interview Nama is she popped up on the radar about a year ago when I first started doing this with It's Toronto Focus, and she does great things and says obvious, sensible, but quite provocative stuff. So I always get a bit of hope from seeing what she's putting out into the world. And then she put this thing out into the world called The Subdivillage, which was just a slightly radical, charming way to look at how we might build better suburban housing that's a bit more dense. Because ultimately, lots of North Americans want to live in the suburbs. My idea of hell, but, you know, at least they're so that's how we set up the conversation. And as you'll see, the Subdivillage comes with a massive disclaimer. And we talk about all sorts of other weird and wonderful ways that we can make housing and the areas where we build housing far more charming. So pulling on a little bit of what Paul Kalbfleisch way back in Series 2 talked about as joyful, here the world is charming. So let's get into it, because this is a great conversation. We've talked about housing relatively recently. I'm going to keep talking about it here because if we build great housing, all the other stuff will fall into place. So without further ado, here is a fantastic conversation all about charm and how to develop it with Nama Blonder. So Nama, thank you so much for taking the time to have a chat with me today. You popped up on my radar as like, oh, hang on, there are people in Toronto who really care and are doing really amazing things. And when I started doing this last year, so I'm going to run a bit of Toronto and Ontario people again, despite...
Well, there are many, many amazing people in Toronto, and I could say for a fact, like really, like I've experienced it on it's part of my journey, and I think also there are many people who care and try to always make a better city. It's harder because we are the biggest city and it comes with its challenges, but I also agree with you, like, yeah, on the other aspect that could be quite disappointing.
You're a trooper. Like, for all the frustration, there are still people who care and do amazing things. So I think that's the important part. But maybe to get started, like, I'd love to get you to do a bit of an introduction in your own words to yourself and your firm and kind of some of the work that you do.
Okay. So I'm an architect and urban planner. I co-founded a company called Smart Density. I haven't done that in a while. But we basically believe that smart density is really how we treat land and how we can make the most efficient use of it. And it could be low density and high density, or low rise and high rise, if you may. And that, of course, it's not every... It could be higher density in still low rise form, but you get my point. And yeah, that's our thing.
So I feel that the density word is like triggering for a lot of North Americans.
Yeah, I've learned it the hard way.
Why does it trigger people?
A negative word for some, and that's okay. These are probably not the people I work with or I call clients, so I learned to live with that. And it's unfortunately true that some will consider that a negative thing. Dense doesn't mean overcrowded, but it's okay. I've heard worse than things convincing people.
So when you, like, the thing that hooked me in to be like, I really have to have a conversation with you was this concept of like the Subdivillage. Which was, I've railed about this before. Of, we often end up in this position of urban types want, oh, they have density in those cities in Europe, we have to be like them. And actually, one of the nice things about North America is you don't have to be like that. But at the same time, we sometimes go too far and reject some of the good principles of what works elsewhere. So I thought you had this interpretation of what suburbs could be that were... Exactly. They don't need to be an evil word to urbanists. It can be a much nicer thing that we might want to live in because they're a part of the different types of fragments of what makes up a city.
So before I get into the Subdivillage, I think we owe the readers and listeners a bit of a background of how I got there, because I also see this as a part of me getting an adult in the industry and in the professional career that I have. And that is, you know, we named our firm Smart Density. Me and my partner, we have two kids. We live downtown in downtown Toronto, like hardcore, no car, getting around on our bike, walking everywhere. And for a very long time, that's what I was preaching. You can even find a story in Toronto Life quoting me saying, "My parks are nicer than your backyards." Like, I was very all in, this is how families should live. I want to say, before I go and say anything about the suburbs, I do believe that the future of Toronto is multifamily housing.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to imagine this place 25 years from now not solving this type of form of housing. Like, the fact that we have single family houses in Toronto near a subway station and our planning system empowers those house owners to object anything that looks differently and higher density and different form, and that is absurd to me.
Mm-hmm.
Because once you cross the ocean, people, families, they raise their kids in apartments. And when I say apartment, by the way, I don't mean the form of tender. It's not rental versus ownership. I don't think that matters. It's the type of what choices and trade-offs you make. And for me, you will not be able to convince me that going and buying somewhere very, very, very far from the city core, whatever that access to job, to culture, to school, to parks, is a better life choice and commuting and having no, you know, none of this around you in immediate proximity is a better choice than giving up square footage and living a different lifestyle. Okay. I just want to make sure that we cover the basics. And I do think that Toronto should really wake up and start realizing that this place will be hell in terms of affordability. Like, we think now we have a crisis. Like, just imagine this place in 25 years from now, if we don't have some radical changes. Okay, so we covered that. And then we saw a stat saying, indicating that 58% of any new homes built are single family detached.
Mm-hmm.
58%. That means that 2/3 of the new, any given moment of new homes being built are single family detached. Single family detached. That's like crazy. That's not even like a cute little triplex, right? Like, single family detached. And that was a shocking number for me to ask, to comprehend. And we said, maybe we should accept that, maybe, you know, that's why I said I see it as like growing up, that many people are still looking for that different quality. And when you look at the original suburbs, they did have some qualities that today's suburbs do not deliver. So even today's suburbs are in the pressure of lower, smaller properties, property lots, because they also need to deliver density. And that comes in a form of just smaller properties, more dense. You see that a lot of them don't have a sidewalk, or some of them only have it on one side. The general experience is overwhelming. Car oriented, yes, even in the suburbs, and I respect it that you cannot rely on transit, so don't get me wrong, but you literally walk there and you see cars parking on the grass that is like between the driveways, and like sometimes you can see like six cars, you know, parking around a single house, and this whole design of like, let's say, a driveway that leads to a two-car garage. And like, so what we said is very simple. Accepting the reality that we ourselves might not, you know, consider ideal, but
oh, it's my idea of hell.
Better. Sorry?
The idea of living in the suburbs and having to do everything in my car is my idea of hell.
Yeah.
I was wondering in a bit of Montreal what has that yesterday.
Exactly. And you know, I was interviewing to the Globe and Mail, and he asked me very wisely, will you live there? And I said, me? No. But hopefully that will be the best suburban configuration we could offer.
Mm-hmm.
But that's also like, I want to make it very clear. When people come into my condo, which is, I'm very, very, very lucky to, you know, I live in a 3-bedroom, like on the spectrum of condos in Toronto, I probably live in a very generous one, but it's not big. It's 1050 square feet. Okay. So just under 1100 square feet. No one walks in into my condo and say, wow, what a generous space you have here. No, it's all very clear that this is tight, compact, and we don't, you know, overstore things, right? Like, it's a lifestyle. But so I just want to make sure that everyone understands that I myself made that trade-off, okay? So it's not like I'm talking about like this condo penthouse, two stories in Yorkville, right? And then we started asking ourselves, how can we make it better? And a lot of it comes to the way we look at streets and street types. And a lot of the suburbs are very well known to be super, like a spaghetti with cul-de-sac and like, oh, let's make them, you know, drive in circles. It's also one way. And it's also like with lots of stop signs just to make it, you know, and I get it. A lot of it is to, you know, coming from 50 years ago. So this is one thing, the way we, you know, arrange the streets on the plan, but it's also the street type itself, because we say that we like to call it the menu of streets. We should have more than one street type, more than one street width. And yes, we also acknowledge that people drive in the suburbs, that cars are here to stay, and we want to accommodate them, but we also want to bring back the car to where it belongs, which is not to over dominate the human experience, even in the suburbs. And I say it all the time that even people who love driving, which I don't know anyone, that will say that about themselves, but I know they exist. Even people who love driving, I would argue that they appreciate walkability. And this walkability, this term is such a soft term. What is walkability? So the way I defined it is that it's pleasant to walk, and you have a place to walk to. And these are the two components that make up walkability. And I think that people who love driving will still appreciate walkability. They still not only appreciate the concept, but also appreciate the opportunity. And when you have streets, what we call the menu of streets, you could have, yes, traditional vehicle, drive here 85 kilometers per hour, go have fun. And other streets that could be car light or car free. That, you know, even if I always say, for example, bike lanes, I would never put a bike lane on the vehicle street because I ride my bike everywhere. And if I have a choice on which street I ride my bike, I will always go to the slower traffic one. So with that, you know, the Subdi Village is a concept that say, okay, let's have the traditional streets, but let's also introduce other types of streets that are, first of all, narrower than the typical right-of-way that the municipality is asking for. And yes, all of our streets have snow removal access and fire safety access. For some reason, that's the number one question I get. And they signal the driver, you need to drive slower here. And these streets are also pretty short, so you don't have to drive slowly for too long. But from that aspect, there is no, you know, we eliminate driveways. We make the right-of-way, which is a nice word to say, the width of the street narrower. It's create a much nicer, more pleasant type of residential street. And that is the big promise beyond the Subdi Village, which I know I took my time to explain, but you got it.
No, I think so. I look at like a city like Toronto and you look at the places now that have historically been zoned for single-family homes only, and they're kind of lovely streets, but that doesn't scale, right? So, but this, and I totally agree on the lifestyle of plenty of people just always known living in a single family home in a residential neighborhood where they get in the car and go to do everything. But I look at the things that the streets we used to build for those kind of homes, like the streetcar suburbs in Toronto, they're lovely places and the property prices reflect that. But you look, I think Calgary is always a Canadian city that I'll pick on for this, but you go to Calgary and it's kind of like looking at a dystopian vision of the world of endless single family homes with not particularly nice yards, with no particular view. And they just look like terribly depressing places to live. But everyone will say, but we're only an hour away from the mountains in Calgary.
And I think the sad part of what you just said is that we kind of, everyone included, okay? Everyone included in this. We gave up. Like this year, we're going to publish a book. It's right now with our final manuscript with our editor called The Building Charm. And one of the things that we say about charm is that no one is even asking for this quality. And I get it. We have crises. We have affordability crisis, sustainability, transportation crisis. I understand that there's no charm crisis, but it's kind of we gave up on even having it as a requirement. And if you look at our even well-designed, I'm not talking about the suburbs of hell, I'm talking about those places that make the effort. A lot of it is the width of the street. We completely lost the scale of human beings. And that is a lot to accommodate the car. And a lot of the time you will hear the transportation engineer saying, we need this lane here, two more parking lanes. Okay, you also want streetcar. Okay, that adds that. Boom, 38 meters right away. And even 38 meters is not the worst I've heard, but also, like, you know, the most intimate residential streets are in today, most of the guidelines are 20 meters, maybe 18 meters wide. So that's really wide.
That's like 9 cars.
That's really wide. That's like, you know, blue or color, like these type of streets.
Yeah.
But in Vaughan Metropolitan Center, which is the new downtown Vaughan is building, that is the most intimate small scale street. And the 36 meters that I gave as an example is also from there. And it's not Highway 7, let me tell you. It's another street within the neighborhood. So definitely something that we lost over time.
Yeah. And then the way that when I see the renderings of what you've designed, it reminds me a little bit of, like, they call them fietsstrats, like the Dutch sort of thing of, like, you can drive a car down the street, but the car is deemed a guest.
Yes.
Whereas our principle is the car is first.
They're different. We call it muse. There are different names, different concepts. I think the innovation that we are trying to, first of all, we're not trying to create innovation, but it's a result, is like how you bring it into the American, North American market.
Mm-hmm.
How do you do that without compromise on the things that a typical developer, a typical buyer will not give up, and that is okay, hence the garage, right? But we also do it first and foremost, it creates a complete different atmosphere once you open the door as the resident. And the second thing is that spending less land on asphalt yields better density without compromising on the quality of the property itself. And that is a very strong benefit to the developer.
Yeah. So what's the reception been like? I know it's still, I'm right in thinking this is still conceptual for now.
So first of all, Subdi Village was a concept that we won an award from the Ontario Association of Architects. They have the what's called the SHIFT program that every 2 years they propose a theme to architects, and they want to demonstrate architectural thinking to the public. So we received that award for the Subdi Village, and since then it was also in the Globe and Mail, and then since then we actually signed 3 new clients, which is great because it's like having all in 6 weeks. It's interesting when you're asking me, but I think the hardest part was for me to accept that I'm now going to talk. Like, I remember the conversation that I had with my partner, and I said, like, are you out of your mind? Like, do you want me to go on LinkedIn, which is like my great platform, and I have, I think, 22,000 followers. And I said, are you out of your mind? Do you want me, after all of these years of preaching people how they should ditch their car and live downtown, do you want me to go like, hey, suburbs are great, move there? And I think that the biggest transformation was for me to accept how I position it. And that wasn't easy. And I think it was overwhelmingly positive, because we were able to touch on something that hasn't seen change, innovation, design attention for so long.
Mm-hmm.
For so long, it's exactly the same. While the other sexier, excuse me, lack of a better word, transit-oriented, higher density, they have seen greater competition, greater attention to detail, greater budget. So it also attracts more, you know, trendy architecture firms willing to work on that. So it was a place that it was relatively easy to stand out, I should say.
So I kind of find that the typical, especially North American transit-oriented development becomes really, really boring. Because more often than not, it's like, here's some towers near a station, and they seem to lack a soul or a personality. in the same way that today's suburbs.
The charm that I was talking about.
Yeah, they don't have the charm. Where, just to finish the thought, is like whereas what you've designed there is, I think really interesting, because it's like, yes, you can have your car, but if you design that well, then if I can get from there to the train station, which might be a mile, might be 3-4 miles, without having to take my car, great, I've got my car at home and I'll keep it and I'll use it to put the bikes on and take the kids out for a bike ride at the weekend and out somewhere on a rail trail, or I'll use it to go to Costco because I don't want to necessarily ditch that part of my lifestyle. But if you get people to ditch the part of I'm going to drive my car downtown, or even I'm going to drive my car to the train station,
you change
the way people live, and that is something that I think not just relying on sticking towers above boxes above train stations is the way to do that.
I want to draw the attention of the exactly how you described it, because I would argue that the greatest opportunity we miss as urban designers and urban planners and people is that even in TOC, transit-oriented communities, transit-oriented developments, we still plan for the car. Like, we're in North America, we don't have enough transit. Full stop, end of story. So we have those rare opportunities that we could do something super. Because for me to come to the suburbs and say, oh yeah, let's do something less car-oriented, okay, that would be a really hard sell. But the fact that we still plan for the car in transit-oriented and we still have those oversized right-of-ways, again, width of the streets, and we follow and we do not question that, and we deliver something that is oversized, and we have here in Canada this formula of a tower on a podium on a massive block on a really wide street, and then it equals tall buildings need really wide streets. Mm-hmm. But it's actually not true. Like, you can solve everything around it without the wide street. And people are going to tell me infrastructure, blah, it's all solvable. Don't buy any excuse. It's simply because we want to accommodate more convenient for the car. And I also want to say to the drivers, like, we know that the more this, and I'm not the expert, but this term called reduced demand, is that how it's called?
Induced demand?
Infused demand, right?
I think it's induced. So if you add more lanes, then the cars will fill the space.
Demand.
Yeah.
Let's see. Induced demand. Induced. I-N-D-U-C-E-D. Induced. That's the word I was looking. Cut this out in the editing.
It's fine.
Induced demand. That, you see, I told you I'm not the expert. At least I said it before. I got that term wrong. But says the more you build, the more you get the psychological decision-making process of how people are using this road. So we know that building more roads do not solve the traffic issues. So that's the only thing I want to offer to propose to rethink the way we do TODs, because that's a really, these are opportunities that we don't have abandoned of, and we don't maximize them for sure.
I feel like we almost make a transit-oriented development so bad that people wouldn't necessarily want it, so then we don't build more of them. But that's just a cynical...
You think so? That's all planned? I don't know. I think people take too much for granted. Mm-hmm. As in, like, okay, they are told you need this, and that's what they deliver.
So then the idea that if you design this... I really like that idea of design for charm. So, like, way back I spoke to Paul Kalfleisch, and he talked about designing for joy. Yeah. I really like how you talk about design for charm.
Yeah.
And that charm deficit, because I can totally imagine how those sorts of streets that you've designed in that plan could also then be, they don't need to be single family homes. I can imagine those things existing in sort of bits of Quebec where they become three triplexes, four, like quadplexes, etc. But you still have the streets that have more character to them that you then, yes, I can drive my car and put it in the garage, but also I might just never take my car out.
Absolutely. And I will say that, first of all, the difference between our book, and first of all, I should read again Happy Cities, because I haven't read it for a while. But we, in this book, we call it the hyper practical guide. Like, it's an actual method. And what you just said is, for me, it relates to the height of the building. But I also want to say, we are totally fine with towers. And we say it's not about the tower itself, it's actually how you embed it in the urban fabric. Mm-hmm. And what you get to experience at grade is, you know, the Montreal type, four stories. And then we still, in some cases, we still need those towers. Towers are not the worst thing that happened to humanity. And that if you ask me to choose, I mean, I don't want to say anything against mid-rise buildings in the form that they exist in Toronto, but I believe that there are more advantages to the low-rise and mm-hmm. the tower combination rather than putting plopping mid-rise buildings all over just because we think it's a compromise the public will be able to accept. And that is something that I want to say. Mid-rise buildings definitely have their qualities. They're really good near open spaces. They frame open spaces very well. But on its own, it kind of gives you the I don't want to say worst of all worlds, but in low-rise, you have the quality of low-rise. It mm-hmm. also creates a much nicer street. And towers, they provide really great unit quality. You have distance views, you have more natural light, you have more natural ventilation just because the nature of the tower being more compact, so you have more corners more often.
Mm-hmm.
And with mid-rise buildings, you just have, you know, most of your units, because the way we build it's like double loaded corridor, right? Like you only have one direction of light, one direction. And if God forbid you do your unit deeper than, I don't know, 9 meters, you get a very deep, very dark units in the mm-hmm. in the back. So something to keep in mind that I think it's that combination of low rise and high rise, and high rises are not the end of the world.
So how do I feel that we're at the point now, and I'm still kind of novice in this realm in a way, but the voices are growing louder and louder. They're getting better at telling the stories, even if I've railed that urbanists are not very good at telling the story. How far away are we from sort of, how do you make some of these changes more real so it's not conceptual?
First of all, with good clients that that believe. No, and that's why I'm so vocal on what I believe in. Like, I'm not hiding. I'm not trying to make them happier. I want my clients, before they reach out, to know what I stand for.
Mm-hmm.
And then when the right clients call, you know, you can get to great results. How do you do the, I think, first of all, it's really, really, really hard. I have a committee of adjustment hearing in 10 days and I got 6 letters of opposition. All of them got the interpretation of the zoning completely. So for me to fight, it feels very overwhelming. It feels like it takes my energy out. Like, how do you start explaining something that they are based on false mm-hmm. assumptions? And that is just one anecdote, and 6 letters are not the end of the world. I had worse, but today is, you know, we're recording it on a certain day and it happens to be 10 days from my next hearing. So it's hard. To answer your question, it's hard. The good aspect of my job is that people do respond to good design. They appreciate it. When it's explained, they appreciate it.
Yeah.
I don't know. Maybe it's part of me getting older and trying less hard to make everyone happy. I don't know.
Oh, I think this is a really important thing. Like, if I was to write my own book on urbanism right now, the number one thing would be, if you're not pissing some people off, you're probably
doing
it wrong.
Your job, for sure.
I've got, so in terms of like making these things real, like, for you, this might be a really naive and dumb question, but like, who's a client, and is it purely about satisfying their needs? Is it also about, I hate the term educating, but it's also about educating the gatekeepers and the policymakers on there are other ways you can do this thing because this is what my client wants?
That's actually a very good, first of all, you know how you said if you were writing your book about urbanism, you always need to bring the benefit to every party. You can never come in as like, oh, this has worked really well for the developer. But also we don't do, like, we always have a triple bottom line. Like, we will never do something for the sake of that we consider bad design. I'm very, very selective on my clients. Very fortunate that I can be so selective. every project that we do needs to check a few boxes. What you just said, I think, is really, really important, because a lot of the time you want to do, you do good design, and I'm not the only one experiencing it. And you go to the city, oftentimes it could come from the transportation department, not even the planning department, and they will not consider this something worth, they don't care about quality, you know, or they could say, hey, we also the gatekeepers of the quality because someone needs to A, B, and C, and your plan doesn't follow our municipal guidelines. The way we were, there are two ways to go about it. Option number one is that in smaller municipalities, you come and convince them that this will be some sort of a legacy project, very unique, and it's in their best interest to work with us to make sure this, you know, being implemented that way. And that requires to perhaps rethink their transportation manuals. By the way, not drastically. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying anything like completely crazy, but yes, it's definitely making their small residential, most intimate, narrower than 20 meters. And the second option is to have the municipal streets in the municipal standards, and the rest will be private streets. Private streets means that there are many advantages and probably one disadvantage, which is maintenance fee, like a condo fee. In this type of like sub-village, condo fees that we have calculated so far comes to about $70 or $80 a month, and it will cover snow removal, waste management, and landscaping. Okay, so by all means, like, it gives you a lot for what you pay for. And the disadvantage is that, yes, it's private and it's under a condo corporation.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not like the condo corporation that I, you know, pay hundreds of dollars for my unit to get a pool and a gym and a concierge. It's not at all in that realm. So this is how we were able to implement it. But I totally, your question is right on, because oftentimes it is very challenging, but I do want to give credit to many, many, many planning teams on the municipal side. When they see good design, a lot of them will go above and beyond to help you get it through. And I had examples when planning told me we're going to override transportation, I've had that, and that is wonderful.
It's like there's a culture of how do we get, we're going to say yes, but how do we get to the point where we can say yes? And then there's a culture of anybody can derail this by saying no. And sometimes there's combinations of the two, but you want to have the former rather than the latter.
Yes. Maybe if we'll talk again in like 2 to 3 years, and we'll see, like, if I can give you the full brochure of challenges and how I...
Yeah.
So far, that... These were my, you know, the intersections when I had to convince, you know, municipal representatives.
I think it's fascinating looking at, like, when I first started doing these interviews, the response from the City of Toronto was like, please go away. But then later on, it was then, hang on, can we have a conversation with you? And it's the, when you make it about a specific opportunity or a specific issue, people, the guards go up and the defences are there. Whereas when it's more about, these are really cool, interesting things that we could be doing, but we're not doing, that's when it was like, how might we do that? And yeah. I think there's like a, it's about being patient and grown up, and you're obviously further like down the curve
Absolutely.
Than I am.
And one thing, as you said that, it's something that I definitely experienced throughout the years of running a business, right? It's like when I just started and like you reach out to people and they don't know, and like they're not very open, and like with time and as you get momentum, things change.
Yeah.
And it's really funny to see the human nature that stand behind this process.
I'm actually quite enjoying. You kind of threw me off track a little bit when we started this. Of we were going to talk more about sub-village, and then you sort of put the caveat at the top of it. Forget the realities, or forget some of the sort of here's the thing that we sort of need to accept. What would you rather be doing? What do you think are sort of better and more interesting right answers to solve the gigantic housing crisis that we have at the moment, not just in Toronto, but across Canada.
I wish, and that is also something that I, you know, if you ask me a very personal question, what I wish for myself, and it's the same answer for what I wish for the city, what I wish to do different, like perhaps to move a little bit faster on mm-hmm. every front. What I hope for myself is for smart density to work globally, internationally, definitely across the country and south of the border, and make places for people to be more charming when they open the door. And that is true in a higher density complex site, and that is true into what you call the suburbs of hell. I do believe that Calgary could benefit from Sub the Village, and it's really about that. And hopefully, as we gain more momentum, but this is what I hope, you know, you said, mm-hmm. like, maybe I'm answering your question a little bit in a more of a personal way. If you ask me what are the things that I'm bothered with and what I'd rather be doing, I think I'm very, 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 very fortunate to be I'm in charge of writing my own script, and I wish, you know, I wish this happiness for everyone. It's very, very rewarding. So I just want to be doing more of what I'm good at, just faster.
Yeah. Do you find there's a little bit of like people, you kind of need to go and live it until you understand the thing that you're missing out on? I've used this example all the time in like transportation, but you don't understand how good a high-speed train is until you've ridden one. You kind of don't understand how...
Wow, that's a great question. First of all, everyone should travel. I say it also to my employees. Every moment that you have, go and travel. This moment will never come back, let alone if you plan to have children. Yes, I think the more you are exposed, especially I think I read this crazy number that more than 50% of Americans, not Canadians, don't have a passport.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you knew that? Okay.
It's when you meet people in America and they sort of say they love to travel. Like my wife has a great story of this guy she met in New Mexico and she did a backpacking trip. And he's like, oh, I love traveling. She's like, oh, where have you been? And he'd been to Arizona.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I thought you're going to say a little bit like more of in the US, but yeah. So exactly like that. So I think people should travel more regardless of housing choices. But there's a lot of cultural things that I don't understand. I don't understand. Me personally, I don't even understand why people object so, like, how come a height of a mid-rise or a building is such a topic of, that is something I know people might hear this or read this and laugh, of like how I don't get it, or roll their eyes, or how I don't get it. I truly don't get it. I truly, truly, truly don't get it. Maybe I have a like lack of empathy there. I don't know, but I it's hard for me to understand. The other thing that I don't understand that is culture, you know, for example, I told you about this committee of adjustment hearing that I have, and like the neighbor was like, oh yeah, okay, I get it. I'm still gonna come to the hearing and object. And like, in my mind, you are the neighbor and you're gonna see this person every day. Your kids might go to the same school. Like, for me, I am trying to have the best relationship with my neighbor I can possibly have. Like, they need me to watch their kids for 2 hours, bring them on, right? Yeah. Like, I just can't understand that mentality and culture of, oh, I'm going to fight you on this without even trying to explain or be convinced otherwise, and bye-bye. So that is, for me, really hard to understand. So you're asking me if, like, they need to experience the... There might be like bigger things under culture, under assumptions that I am just unable to understand.
I find it weird when people go, I don't understand how people can raise kids in a condo. And it's like, well, just rent an apartment on holiday for a couple of weeks and see what it's like living in an apartment or whatnot. Like, it's the, like, there's a sort of thing of like, just before you object, go try it.
Yeah.
Like, it's like kind of like being in a restaurant of like, that you might not like the sound of an ingredient, but go taste it. And if you don't like it, you don't like
it. That's actually a very good analogy for sure.
And it's like the same thing for like planning consultations of, you only ever get the people who turn up are the sort of 6 loudest voices who really hate it, not the 6,000 people who go, not bad.
Exactly. And they're not coming, and city planning, and well, it's also, it's, I actually don't think it's something that city planning doesn't know. I think it's something that, because our housing is so political, so it's just all a facade that councillors are putting in order to use. I don't think anyone believes that this 1% represents anything real.
Does anywhere do it really well? Do you look at anywhere and go, oh my God, I hate people that go, we should be more like Amsterdam because that's so boring. But do you look at anywhere and go, I really admire that. I want to sort of be inspired by it.
No, I'm not familiar enough with political democratic systems of housing. I mean, I wasn't born here, but it's not like my home country will be any better in like NIMBYism is a very North American thing.
Yeah.
Full stop, because of the own my land, I own the house, it's part of democracy, and like it will never be a dictatorship because you won't be able to, right? Like the land is owned by individuals. So therefore, that's like, and by the way, don't get me wrong, I'm not like, that was not a political statement of what is right, wrong. It's not like communism is the solution, right? But that NIMBYism is rooted in that, and that's why we suffer way more in North America.
Yeah.
So I don't know how it is in Amsterdam. I wish we were less political. That is, like, we are here in this crisis because everything is highly political mm-hmm. in the housing delivery.
I have a thing I'm exploring at the moment is the issue, and I've totally been inspired by someone else who sort of pointed out, but like, is the Duke of Wellington to blame for why we have a housing crisis? And the theory behind it is that countries that have more Napoleonic law is more around like the power of the state trumps the power of the individual, whereas the sort of Anglo version of it is the power of the individual trumps the power of the state. Mm-hmm. So being British, you have the sort of an individual can stop or can have a judicial review of a major project and their legal costs get capped at a small amount of money. Whereas like the French version of it is like a lot of you really need to take issue with this project to get in the way of it. And I say this as somebody who has a tattoo of the Duke of Wellington on their arm.
Wow, that's a cool tattoo. Okay.
I don't know if that's real, but like, I think it's something I'm like very curious about now. Is this why the cultures that have the worst housing crisis and the ones that struggle to build the most actually, well, like that's what gets in the way?
I don't know. I never thought about it. I never spent time thinking about like that. I did ask myself if we suffer from homelessness
mm-hmm.
worse than homogeneous countries. And if it's like because we're so multicultural, but without the shared values, right? Like without the melting pot, there is no melting pot here.
Mm-hmm.
And I was asking myself, like, what? Otherwise, how would you explain that there's the homelessness here is like nothing else like you see in the Middle East?
No, there's like I find there's a Toronto culture, and it happens in other cities as well. But it's we like to say how multicultural we are, but actually the integration is homogenization, and it's almost like the removal of culture. So like, I remember like walking down one of the, I think it was like Dundas West Festival last year, and you'll see people speaking, or people who look like they're from all different parts of the world, but they all end up dressing the same. And they're probably listening to the same music and they're talking about the same things. And it's sort of like it's not multicultural. It's sort of, they become a monoculture rather than something that takes the best of all these different parts of the world. And I think that's actually, it's one of the biggest things that we don't like to talk about because it's an inconvenient truth. But like, if you look at where those people have come from, they've come from Spain, they've come from France, they've come from the UK, they've come from Middle East, where they all have their own cultures of being better communities. So I think there's something really interesting to that. I don't know the answer. I just think there's something interesting to it.
But it is something that I like. You cannot walk in Toronto and not be bothered deeply, mm-hmm. and you can say whatever it is the government's responsibility, it is not, it's the run, and that it is a problem, full stop. And who, you know, and even the most like ultra conservative, I would say, frame it as a problem for them because of property value enhancing public realm. Like, there are some really scary parts in the city right now with encampments, and I don't think it's contributing to our city.
It's interesting when you speak to visitors to Toronto, Montreal, they're kind of up, they're almost impressed by those homeless people have built some incredibly impressive encampments. I was riding through a park in Toronto a few weeks ago, and there was a delivery of firewood to a collection of homeless people in a park in a nice neighborhood.
Yeah.
And nobody was batting an eyelid. I'm like, one, I'm really impressed that these people have banded together and have got a wood delivery to a park. And two,
yeah,
if we can do that, surely we can find a roof. It's fucked.
I wonder how, you know, because there's research showing that taking care of them later on in like a medical, right, mm-hmm. like public health system costs us way more. So like that's what I'm saying. Like there are ways to frame it, even for the ultra conservative. That's why it's our problem.
Yeah, and then you see there's one very ultra-conservative person that I follow just to see different views on LinkedIn, but he rails against one, like a development of tiny homes in Hamilton, and you see how much it's been costing to develop the tiny homes, and he's upset by that. Anybody should be upset by the price tag of it, but nobody should be upset by the principle of helping people have a home.
Right.
And I think that's where it all gets messed up with if we just went, well, you could design a quite basic apartment building that might not necessarily have an awful lot of charm, but that would be a lot cheaper than having the argument that then Absolutely. Leads to the bad solution being really, really expensive. We're going down a bit of a dark route, and I want to bring it back to
it's
sort
okay.
of,
I
of
knew I knew it's gonna be because it does touch so many other aspects, so I knew that's why I told you, like, don't worry if it derails, but please.
I'd love to sort of come back to I like to do the magic wand question towards the end of these things. So if you had a magic wand and you could wave it at sort of, maybe it's the work that you do, maybe it's the city that you live in Toronto, maybe it's something more sort of fantastical. What would you do with the magic wand to make Toronto a better challenger city?
Well, Toronto, again, I just want to make sure the Stubbed Village is not for Toronto. The same way that I say that the triplex and fourplex that people think that it's like, oh, wow, we made the missing middle. That's not for Toronto. Toronto is the biggest city in Canada that attracts immigrants, should attract more opportunities. And for that, we should not do something like that. We should rethink what is density, what is family living, and everything that we talked on the beginning mm-hmm. of it. Magic wand, I would to see more drastic change faster. Mm-hmm. That's my magic wand, and I could apply it on different aspects for Toronto, for public opinion, for housing crisis, for my personal success. Like, I think that's what we need. Everything happens very, very, very slow. The nature of blah, blah, blah. That's not like I think it should be opening it up faster.
Yeah.
And it might be that politics stands in the way, but still, like, that's the way I look at it.
It's kind of like paying a loan, but you're only paying off, like, you're not even paying off the interest of the loan because you're moving so slowly. So, like, the thing that you need to solve has become, the problem, like, festers and becomes worse and worse. To me, that's the Toronto thing of, like...
I never thought about it that way, but that's a good analogy.
Because I like the sort of, I love missing middle stuff's cool. I love the place that I now live in Montreal, like as a sort of quadplex on a street, 3 metro stations from the middle of downtown.
Yeah.
And I think that can work in pockets of Toronto, but like you'd need another city to fill the gap. And it's
exactly.
all of the above.
Because
right?
when you do a triplex in Toronto, you just make the property value so much higher that no one will be able to pick it up and actually do what we need. The second thing that I will say is that de facto, this city already operates in triplexes and fourplexes because many of the houses that you see downtown, at least, are every floor is a different unit. It's just illegal. So the city won't have data. The city will not also admit because it's illegal. So they also don't have data because it's illegal. But I am saying that we have triplexes de facto and we're in this crisis. Making it kosher not going to help. It's not going to deliver what we need. In fact, it's going to make it harder because it's much harder to meet code.
Mm-hmm.
And it's great for Mississauga and Brampton and Vaughan and what else do we have, right? Pickering and Ajax and Oshawa. Toronto needs to allow 4-story, 6 stories as of right, whatever makes it single egress to like really, like, you know, and when I say 4-story, 6 stories, I mean the most controversial, right? Like the hardcore of the neighborhoods. No, I don't want it to be quoted of like, she said 4 or 6 stories is the optimal height. This obsession of it has to look like a house, but don't worry, it's a triplex, or it's a triplex, but don't worry, it looks like a house.
Yeah.
That is something that we really need to get to move away from.
What's the project that you're sort of hope? I think this is like maybe the nice place to sort of land on, because I want to make it a bit about you and smart density. But what's the project that you're most sort of proud
all of
about?
This is about me. The past 90 minutes is about me, or an hour. But we enjoy the most the larger scale, and I think that's why Sub the Village has been successful, because we have a big enough plot of land that we could introduce stormwater management solutions and like streets that like we have enough meat with something with like a downtown Toronto site that I'm sure many architects that would be their dream is less on my top three of my wish list, because what I want is really like the urban design, right? Like mm-hmm. these are the things that we, not just me, find the most attractive and then the greatest impact longer term, but greatest impact.
No, I mean, you're a pleasure to speak to. I know we could go on, but I just really appreciate you sort of taking the time to sort of share some of that. And
no, thank you so much for reaching out. I look forward to, amplifying this.
No, you give me so much confidence, because I complain and I bitch and I moan and I can be a bit of a curmudgeon about Toronto. But I think the fascinating thing about the city is that it has so many voices and so many people doing their little bits of things that hopefully become much bigger things to make cities and neighborhoods and areas like joyful, full of charm, pick whichever term that we want. It kind of just needs the city to sometimes get out of its own way to sort of let more of it happen and be like, oh yeah, this is really good. So those sorts of people like you and what you're doing just fill me with hope. So thank you
so much.
Yep, that's the end of the podcast. Usual things apply. If you liked it, give it a like. If you really liked it, give it a share. If you think you know somebody who would be into this, send it to them. If you are a Toronto resident and you want to have an impact in the city of Toronto, pester your local councillor or elected representative with these kinds of things. And because I have to ask, because I want to boost it, leave a comment, give it a rating, and loads more of these will be coming up soon. Also, do get in touch if you have someone that you want to be on this or you think there's a topic we've missed, because those things are good. Capiche? Excellent. See you later. Bye.